Hi guys, we're Mary and Vanessa, the host of True Crime Dropouts.
Join two best friends and former criminal justice majors as they pretend to know all things true crime.
So sit down, grab a broom, drive, we really don't care, and give us a listen. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and anywhere really.
And don't forget, stay in school, or you'll end up like us, degreeless without that fabulous FBI job.
Hello and welcome to Historia Canadiana. My name is Patrick and this is a show about Canadian culture and the way it informs this nation's history. On this episode, in our steady path towards the rebellions of 1837 and 1838, we'll be covering the ways in which there was an incredibly vocalized segment of the Canadian population, mostly from Francophone Lower Canada, that wished to distinguish itself within the greater British North American landscape. In past episodes of the show, the influence, impact, and broad historical events that involved the French speakers of what would later be called Canada have been mostly touched upon as separate entities, much like the other provinces that were pretty much left to their own devices, and only nominally referred to as a greater entity. As the 1830s came closer to their endpoint, this dynamic would shift in a way that was much more easily recognizable. As such, through the focal point of a book by Philippe Ignace François Aubert de Gaspé, boy, I won't be saying that whole name too many times this episode. Let's look at the ways in which French Canadians continued to distinguish themselves in North America. In part as a bid to survive in the face of an increasingly English-speaking hegemony, in part due to national pride, in part due to a series of events from beyond the borders of Lower Canada that increased a sentiment that the French in these colonies had a different heritage that was leading to a different destiny. All of these aspects will be explored in greater depth today in the hopes of shedding some light into the rise of French-Canadian distinctions in a Canada that, at least on paper, was trying to accommodate them. Now, obviously, I don't want to detract from the rumblings that were also occurring in Upper Canada for slightly different reasons. I merely wanted to focus on Lower, then Upper Canada, in a separate episode so as to better manage this all. Alright, let's do this. I want to start this episode with a quick story about where the Francophone element in Canada stands right before the rebellions. This is a story about a small newspaper that made it big and that will help us get onto the topic of how the French Canadians saw and expressed themselves in a post-Constitutional Act world. For more information on that act, check out episode 16 about the history of the government in Canada. Let's talk about a newspaper called Le Canadien, which translates to The Canadian. Considered to be French Canada's first political newspaper, Le Canadien was founded by members of the Parti Canadien, Canadian Party, in 1806, with an aptly representative motto, "Our language, our religion, our laws." The Parti Canadien has its own interesting history, which I might get to later, but for our purposes, it's useful to know that it was basically the first political party in Canada, and sought to represent French-Canadian interests in a British system. Early in its history, though, it was still actively working within that system, with no intention of completely removing itself from it. Anyway, the newspaper's early editions were distinguished by a firm grasp of those British constitutional principles, an early formulation of the idea of responsible government, a defense of the Canadiens and their traditions, and professions of loyalty to the Crown. It stood in opposition to the Quebec Mercury, which was a newspaper created by British Tories and whose members soon also created a political coalition which has been retroactively called the English Party. In essence, the editors of Le Canadien knew what the system was about and how to criticize it, work within it, and hopefully change it. The Parti Canadien had a decidedly greater advantage over the English Party, though, as roughly 80% of the legislative assembly seats, which was the only elected body in Canada at this time, if you'll recall, were rural francophone ones, the exact demographic sought out by the Parti Canadien. The paper's success and the electoral victories of the party it supported alarmed the colony's francophobic governor, Sir James Craig, who had its presses seized in April of 1810 and imprisoned its editors. Craig was, by all accounts, an asshole, who went out of his way to criticize and dismantle the concessions that the British power had been giving the French Canadians since the conquest. The elimination of this francophone newspaper was one step he took among many. I wanted to begin with this story because of how emblematic it is of the French-Canadian situation at the time in Lower Canada. While the theoretical ability of the French Canadians to exist on their own terms within the British colonies was still officially in place, the early life of Le Canadien, which sought to promote their voices to a wider audience, is somewhat counterintuitive to that idea. There were a few reasons why the newspaper failed in a sense, but I want to cover two in particular. On the one hand, Le Canadien, in its initial form, still ostensibly played by the rules of the British. Any perceived dissent, as Governor Craig perceived it, would therefore be easily removed or eliminated, as it was still, by definition, functioning within a very predictable model, and an easily recognizable one. The other failure to really arouse genuine change comes from our great old friend, the Catholic Church. You see, while religion was always an important part of colonial and especially French colonial life, it became seen as even more necessary in the aftermath of the French Revolution, when the anti-clericalism that rose up in that period was seen as having a direct influence on the chaos and terror that Republican France rapidly devolved to. The clerical elites in Lower Canada, while naturally being a part of the elite that benefited from a lack of rocked boats, preached that their continued presence and the presence of the stable British power is what will help Lower Canada the most in remaining a just society. Basically, the Catholic Church held a grip on its population and a kind of laissez-faire attitude toward the government that it was a part of. This was obviously not helped by the fact that the church was also in charge of many educational institutions, and so was influential in the classroom, as well as during Sunday Mass. If we flash forward a few decades, our approach to these ideas becomes a bit different. With that time difference, many things changed. The English-speaking areas that surrounded and were related to Lower Canada became stronger and concretized, both geographically as Upper Canada, the Maritimes, and the United States grew in importance and power, and politically as the British aristocracy continued in the imperially associated stance that it had been upholding for some time. On the other side of the coin, though, the liberal reform movements were starting to have more and more ground on which to hold firmly in their beliefs that something in the government had to change, right? This will for responsible government that I've been mentioning, this will for a government that actually represents the people. In this scenario, you not only see the rise of the number of vocal criticisms, but of genuinely informed ones that come from the general population. We can easily return to the example of the newspaper that we started the show with, which was revived in the 1820s, seemingly unable to be killed by its imprisoned and dissenting editors. I also want to bring some attention, even if it wouldn't have a genuine impact until much later, to Napoleon and his law code, the aptly named Napoleonic Code, as another factor to take into consideration into the rise of French-Canadian nationalistic sentiments. We've already seen that Lower Canada had its own laws based on the French tradition, starting in 1791, long before the Napoleonic Code was ever instituted. Later, in the 1860s, that area's laws would reflect the latter code. But in the interim between the two, I think it's at least important to mention the impact that Napoleon had on Francophone mentalities. At least to some degree, while it wouldn't be overt in Lower Canada, there was a sense among many French speakers that Napoleon was bringing a sense of grandeur back to France. As we've seen, France is still a place that nostalgically existed in the hearts of many French Canadians. So while it wouldn't directly inform the decision-making process, I don't think it's a stretch to say that many would seize this resurgence in French power to remake ties to the previous motherland and use it as, at least mentally, a jumping-off point for a greater sense of Francophone destiny in Canada. All right, now back to the newspaper that was being revived. Under Étienne Parent, the Canadien newspaper returned as the voice of French-Canadian discontent and demands into the 1820s and 1830s. It maintained relatively the same stance as its prior incarnation, but promoted a more active participation from its population in advocating for responsible government. Although the exact place of a revolt or rebellion in this case waxed and waned. For a time, especially at the beginning of Étienne Parent's editorship, the Canadien continued to support the political party whose members it was tied to, the Parti Canadien. At this point, the leadership of that party had shifted, and pretty soon, so would its name. Heading the liberal-minded group was none other than Louis-Joseph Papineau, the lower Canadian leader of the eventual group known as the Patriotes, aka the Patriots, who were basically the principal group of the rebellions in Lower Canada. Papineau and Parent would eventually have a falling out, but I thought I would mention this relation as a nice way to open up to the ways in which popular criticism and mass movements were related to this period of Canadian history. With that being said, I think it's time for a quick break. When we come back, we'll be discussing the other ways that French Canadians distinguished themselves in British North America and talk about our book and the way it fits into all of this. In thinking about the rise of the novel in British North America, the French Canadian path is found to be one that was a bit bumpier. As I mentioned before the break, there is more to the use of the novel than a way to tell a story. In fact, it became much more than that in Lower Canada. As the 1830s rolled around, through the increase in newspaper publications and the number of schools, public or otherwise, the ability of people to read and write naturally increased. Let's be clear here, it was still mostly those of higher social standing that managed to get that education for a significant period of time, and who were listened to when their ideas were actually disseminated. But it's something to take note of nonetheless. An interesting way to show this increase in literacy is in the increase of literary societies in the colonies during the 19th century. Professor and historian Heather Murray describes them as such, quote, "An important form of cultural, educational, and social organization in early Canada, and the forerunners of modern book discussion clubs. Literary societies took literature to mean belles lettres, and rhetorical study broadly defined. Book discussion, debate, essay reading, dramatic performance, and recitation. Unlike more recent clubs, which focus on a single text, literary societies often included musical interludes and current events discussions in their programs. Many groups undertook cultural promotion or civic improvement projects." End quote. One of these groups, so that we can tie this back to our subject, was called the Literary and Historical Society of Quebec, and was founded in 1824. It was one of the most successful versions of literary societies in early Canada, and certainly demonstrates, as the idea of literary societies do in general, an interest in the cultural importance and education of Canada and the inhabitants that were trying to gain some ideas of their own within it. But there was also some issues in the way people of the time viewed things like the novel and literature in Lower Canada. While it was an increasingly used form, there was a lot of suspicion in the use and writing of the novel as we know it today. There's an excellent study about it called Les Infortunes du Roman dans le Québec du 19e siècle, The Misfortunes of the Novel in 19th Century Quebec, if ever there are Francophones listening that want to know more about that subject. Anyway, certain criticisms launched at the literary form were often advising future novelists to observe high moral standards and would urge those who wanted to read novels to be very careful when selecting them, because they could easily be exposed to immoral ideas and descriptions, unlike the high forms of literary art like poetry. Our old friend Étienne Parrain, the newspaper editor from earlier, even denounced the reading of European novels as an utter waste of time and effort. He argued that these novels were incapable of giving anything of substance to Canadians, except perhaps immoral thoughts and impossibly high hopes. One of the reasons for this was because many of them were describing societies and habits that were not French-Canadian. It wasn't the same reality. It is within that context that the relevance of the novel took on a different form of sorts. The intention behind writing one would not only be to ensure the proper moral standing and maintenance of good values in a good Catholic Lower Canada, as indicated by the claims to purity of thought that many authors would preface their books with for good measure. It would also become a way to promote a sense of national belonging and patriotism. Like many places in the world at this time of empire, the novel was used to promote certain values and to exemplify the best that a people can be. The British used it extensively in their colonies to show their so-called higher artistic capabilities. As the rebellions approached and an increased need for self-definition mounted in Lower Canada, the novel was what became one of the methods of choice to distinguish the French-Canadian voice from the rest of the British North American colonies and the United States. Professor Jacques Cottenham, in an overview of the development of the novel in French, stated that, quote, "A good novel was soon defined as one that was didactic, patriotic, and edifying. In such a context, it is easy to understand that historical novels and novels of the land, that is, novels promoting an agricultural ideology and fidelity to tradition, were largely favored in Quebec," end quote. With that being said, I think it's enough context to get us to talk about Philippe Ignace François Aubert de Gaspé. That's theoretically just two names, by the way. Compound names truly are the worst. And his book entitled L'Influence d'un Livre, which translates to The Influence of a Book. Let's start with a bit of a background history on our author for today, who, from now on, I'll simply refer to as Aubert de Gaspé, much shorter that way. If ever you look him up, by the way, make sure you're not looking up his father, who has a similar name and who is also an author, a much more prolific one and popular one, actually, but who wrote after his son actually passed, so he doesn't matter for the context of the show. Born in Quebec City on April 8, 1814, Aubert de Gaspé was initially educated in the so-called classical learning, that is, learning about literature, history, and the arts, at the Séminaire de Nicolet, before he would begin a career as a stenographer and a journalist. He would actually end up working and publishing for two ideologically conflicting newspapers, the Tory one that we've mentioned before, the Quebec Mercury, and the one that just keeps coming back on this show, Le Canadien. Honestly, it's as if there were only two papers at the time. Aubert de Gaspé was quite the shit disturber over the course of his lifetime, and he used the increasing instabilities and tensions that were growing in the two Canadas to pull a few tricks that could not only garner a laugh, but also stir some more liberal sentiments. For example, he would end up being imprisoned for a month in 1835 following an altercation with a member of parliament who had accused him of being dishonest and libelous. Funny enough, the MP who clashed with him, Edmund O'Callaghan, would also be a more liberal-minded person. So it's not like he would accuse someone like Obaid Gaspé simply because he disagreed with his politics, which, trust me, was a thing at the time. Regardless, after he got out of prison, Obaid Gaspé avenged himself by planting a stink pot in the vestibule of the Legislative Assembly. He was then obliged to go into this self-imposed exile in the family manor house at Saint-Jean-Pangéry. Let's be honest, it's not the worst place for an exile is a stately manor, but I think we all know at this point what it's like to be stuck in a house for a while, so I kind of sympathize with him a bit. Just a bit. He would pass the time there by reading fiction and writing his very own novel. Actually, it would be the first of its kind to be published by a French Canadian. And it was released by subscription in September of 1837, just as the rebellions were taking shape. Now, L'influence d'un livre has absolutely nothing to do with the rebellions themselves. It was written before they happened and released as they began. Where the book is an important milestone, though, is what it tries to do as a piece of French-Canadian literature around this time, and the context surrounding its release. Before we go into that, how about I enlighten you folks with what the story is about? Something that I think will segue quite nicely into what its influences were and why those are important. The title itself refers to a popular manual of superstitious recipes that encouraged the main character of the novel, Charles Amin, to seek the Philosopher's Stone, and by extension, riches. Riches beyond compare. You see, Charles is an eccentric amateur alchemist, living in the 1820s on the shores of the St. Lawrence River, where he spends most of his time trying out these insane experiments. One of his macabre attempts requires the use of a black hen stolen at the full moon, which is supposed to help him summon Mephistopheles, the devil, which will allow him to bargain for these unimaginable riches. Another involves what is known as the main de gloire, literally a hand of glory, which is the dried arm of a hanged man. Amin goes to great lengths to fulfill his experiments, as he acquires the appendage by removing it from a dissection room he infiltrates after the execution of a murderer. His adventures and experiments have him travel around, meeting a series of characters that have had supernatural encounters, presumably with the very same devil that Amin is trying to summon, and who have led pious lives since. Obviously, their warnings fall on deaf ears, and our main character keeps going on his quests. But his work, if it can so be called, also make him a kind of pariah, a misunderstood exile among his own. One day, while searching for a treasure that will hopefully help him, Charles is played by a group of practical jokers who hide an empty casket in hopes that he would find absolutely nothing. This in itself is nothing new. People cease to take him seriously very quickly. In fact, the chicken that I mentioned earlier is not stolen at all by his lackey, it's just bought from a farmer, which apparently just ruins the experiment. In a bizarre turn of fate, later on in the story, he ends up shipwrecked off Anticosti Island, which is just north of Prince Edward Island and New Brunswick. There, Amin will suffer from an endless series of disappointments, until, after about 5 years, he finds a modest treasure of $500. Meanwhile, as all good stories of the time had, we are also introduced to a love story between Charles's daughter, Amélie, and her elegant young lover, a medical student known as Saint-Sérin. Prior to his five-year-long shipwreck, Amin was staunchly against the relationship and refused that they get married. Unbeknownst to the main character, the marriage does take place during his absence, as he's believed dead. To the couple's great surprise, upon his return, Charles is not critical of their decision, having come to terms with the fact that some things change, and that the happiness of his family is more important than he thought. Despite this revelation, the man continues in his alchemical work, although with slightly less of a penchant to involve the devil. All right, what was the point of this story? Well, remember when I mentioned that the novel was viewed as a lower form of art at this time, especially when placed alongside quote-unquote higher forms like poetry? One of the reasons for that criticism was that it took a lot of ideas from Europe, and that it didn't really represent the values of the burgeoning colonies and its people. L'influence d'un livre was an early attempt to rectify this perception, and I don't think it's entirely coincidental that it happened around the time when the liberal and progressive people of the Canadas were starting to self-define more and see themselves as outside of a purely European perspective. If it was a coincidence, well, that's quite surprising. But it doesn't really stop the explanation that I want to make. While certainly wanting to set a high moral standard for the readers who might be apparently wrongfully influenced by a novel, according to the critics, L'influence d'un livre keeps up the posture of being a text with a deep-seated moral fiber. That aspect of it should have gotten through just by the summary that I provided for you guys. Where it truly becomes more interesting is in the way that it approaches these moral questions. It does so by pulling from the tradition of folk tales that had existed in French Canada for a very long time. Actually, since the arrival in the 17th century of the first coureurs des bois, as they were known, or settler woodsmen. We'll get into the details of that folk tradition in a full episode at a later point, but it's important to note for some time here as something that shows a distinctive French-Canadian voice in a highly colonial genre like the novel. There are two aspects to the French-Canadian folktale that should be highlighted here as they relate to Aubert de Gaspé's work. The first is the oral mode of transmission that was common of folktales, as they were told around a fire to pass the long winter nights, or to entertain and moralize before going to bed. And the second is their often fantastical and supernatural nature, that pulls from a fear of the unknown world of the colonies. The oral mode itself takes on many forms in the text. First off, the story itself is written with a narrator that interjects and comments on the unfolding plot. We may understand this kind of narrative device today as a form of meta-narration, of the author talking to their audience. But in this case, my interpretation, considering the relative novelty of the literary form and the lack of development in such modes, would be that this is a type of remnant of the oral storytelling tradition. The narrator, and the way the story is told, that is, in a way uncommon to what we would understand as a novel today, recall a tale that is recounted by someone who is thinking of things on the spot, things that are meant to be sensational and impressive to listen to and enjoy in the moment. Today, you'd expect major character arcs or a well-defined goal. But there isn't really any of that in L'influence d'un livre, because that's not how stories are traditionally told in oral folklore. One thing happens and then another, and you always have to keep the interest of the listening public by constantly upping the game, if you will. And that's why you get shipwrecks and deals with the devil and morbid adventures to a morgue, and so on. These storytelling methods are actually seen in the stories themselves that the book tells. Many characters, as I mentioned before, spend some time telling their own stories of encounters with the devil and the terrible consequences that that engendered. The protagonist, Charles Amin, visits an uncle, for example, who tells the tale around a gathered family of a girl who wouldn't stop dancing and twirling because of a meeting with good old Mephistopheles, who was compelling her into such bizarre and slightly lewd public acts. These meetings with otherworldly creatures and forms of magic offer a nice transition into another common element of the French folktale. As we've talked about in previous episodes, namely episode 15, one of the great fears that colonists had in the so-called New World was of the unknown lurking in the wilderness. This is not only a fear that manifested itself early on in tales of beasts and insanity, but also the possibility of human moral and physical deterioration. In a world where settlers had to go through admittedly horrifying conditions at times, these were the perfect kinds of stories for two reasons. One, they allowed them to process the things that they went through. And two, and this brings us back full circle to the apparent influence of the novel, it allowed people to tell stories about overcoming faults and slips in morality and values. What better way to convince a people to act in a good way than by pitting them against figures like Satan himself? Now, Aubert de Gaspé's novel, L'Influence d'un Livre, was not greatly received in its time. While, by the author's own admission, it was based in parts on real-life events, figures, and tales, critics at the time were not favorable to its lack of realism. Add to that the fact that the rebellions were kicking off as it was being released to the consuming public, made for a trailblazing book that few people actually read. Nevertheless, as I have been alluding to, this book is better understandable for what it was trying to prove and when it was trying to prove it, not what it was actually saying. The story, while it had some traditional elements to it that would have appealed to the public, is not what I would take the most out of in this first French-Canadian novel. Instead, it is important to remember that, as Upper and Lower Canadians were gearing up to face against the British aristocratic stranglehold on their government, there was equally a movement among Francophones to assert their cultural differences. These were a people that felt their culture being threatened from the inside and out by an Anglo-centric continent that made little room for French growth. So as tensions were rising about the role of government, other tensions were naturally mounting about the place of a people within Canada. L'influence d'un livre, more than anything, indicates a will, a need even, to create something that is unequivocally French-Canadian at a time when that was increasingly an uncertain concept. Pulling from traditional modes and adapting them to something that a wide and educated audience could read, Aubert de Gaspé kickstarted a form of resistance against British and English hegemony in North America, and brought attention to the need for the survival of French Canadians. Unfortunately, the author would die soon after its release in 1841 in Halifax, never to see the extent to which his book would have an influence on the way French-Canadian stories were crafted, and that these stories were used to bring an increasingly louder voice to the forefront of the Canadian cultural scene. Okay, that is it for this episode. Thank you everyone for listening. You can reach out with any questions, comments, or concerns on the Facebook page, through Twitter, and by email. All links are in the description. You can also support the show through the Ko-fi page or by PayPal donations and through affiliate links in the recommended reading page I set up. Also, if you're interested, I finally got around to some perks like extra episodes, which you can find on Patreon. Took me long enough, right? Anyway, all this is optional and the show will still remain free and independent if you don't want to do any of that. Finally, if you could leave a review on iTunes and share it with some friends, it would be very appreciated. It helps to boost the show and get it into more people's ears. For now, I'll just say that I wish you all an excellent health and that I hope you and your loved ones can stay safe in these really intense times. I'll see you next time on Historia Canadiana. Cheers, everyone.